Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is an official podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Becca Barris, writer and copy editor for the Journal of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who work in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the field. These are people who represent the cutting edge in emergency dispatch, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today we're talking about chaplains in EMS and emergency dispatch. Here to give his insight is Chaplain Russell Myers with Allina Health EMS in Minneapolis. Russ is ordained by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and is board certified with the Association of Professional Chaplains. He worked as a hospital chaplain for many years before being invited to serve as EMS chaplain in 2007. Welcome, Russ.
Hi, great to be here.
We're excited to have you. We haven't had a chaplain on the podcast before. How does it feel to be the very first?
Well, one of the things I've discovered is I've been in this job for 14 years now, and I don't have very many professional peers. I know a few people who do some support work on a part-time or volunteer basis, but I think this is really a new and emerging field for chaplaincy, and I guess I get to be a pioneer in this.
That's so exciting. So before we get into what a chaplain is and how it relates to EMS, could you give us just a quick rundown of your career path?
Sure. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I worked in a congregation for about 5 years. I went back and did some clinical training at a level 1 trauma hospital and landed a job at United Hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I worked there for a long time. And it was during that time when I was at a meeting of some organization leaders talking about a different topic, really. But one of the people in the audience was the chief of our EMS division. And he contacted me a few weeks later and said, you know, I know you were there to talk to the hospital people, but I'd really like to see what we might be able to do for support for our paramedics. They really have a high-stress job. And, you know, my first reaction was to say, well, that sounds like a great idea, but I already have a job. I'm not looking. But he was persistent. And I got to thinking, you know, maybe this is an opportunity and I'd like to see it done well. And I'd been in hospital work for a long time and thought maybe branch out a little bit. So the first year it was a 0.2. And to be honest, I didn't know much about EMS, probably as much as the general public. I thought everything was, you know, 911 and, you know, high drama and high trauma. What I came to realize, of course, is that EMS is those things, but it's also a lot more. And among all the people in our organization, you know, there were the 911 paramedics, the EMTs who mostly focus on interfacility, you know, from hospital to hospital or hospital long-term care, and then the dispatchers, which were another whole group of people that, you know, they're kind of at the end of the hall in this dark room, and I didn't know they were there. So I thought, well, if I'm here to support the whole organization, I started hanging out with everybody, doing ride-alongs with the ambulance crews and the wheelchair van drivers and sitting along with the dispatchers and going to meetings and education events and just trying to learn what it was all about.
That's excellent. So let's back up a little bit. What is a chaplain? How is that different from being a pastor or a minister or, you know, any other role in a church?
The biggest distinction, I think, one is that chaplaincy is intended to be working in secular situations. You know, so if I was working in a congregation, I might be doing the similar work that I'm doing now, but I wouldn't call that chaplaincy. And that's kind of changed over the years. You know, chaplaincy has really come into its own. It used to be more of a job or a vocation, and it's kind of evolved more to be like a profession. And I think probably the same thing could be said about people in EMS. You know, I've seen that in the literature. Is being a paramedic a vocation or is it a profession? And how are they the same or different? So it's kind of like that for chaplains as well. You know, it involves clinical training and board certification. And in the past, a lot of times people were congregational ministers and would get jobs as chaplains with no additional training. It was just a change in venue. What we're realizing is that it can be a lot more stressful, a lot more clinical. So the training model is called clinical pastoral education. that chaplains are expected to have. And one of the things that makes it really different, though, and challenging at times, there's no national standards, there's no licensing. There's been proposals to license chaplains, but that gets a little risky because, you know, then we're handing over the authority to somebody who may not know a whole lot about what we do. So the route that chaplaincy has gone is more toward professional certification. And there's a number of certifying bodies that have their own take on the standards. It's essentially, you know, graduate theological education and the clinical training. So some chaplains have worked in congregations. In my generation, that was the model. Most of us came out of congregational ministry and then made a lateral move into some other setting. What I'm seeing in a lot of the people in the next coming up generation are people who finish their education and want to go directly into chaplaincy. So they don't have the congregational experience. And in many cases, maybe they don't need it. It doesn't really apply to what they're doing as chaplains.
Mm. Interesting. So it sounds actually a lot like dispatch, right? It's a relatively new field that people are starting to explore as a career. And there's the issue of certification versus licensing because people don't know a lot about it. So when you came to Allina Health, EMS, what did the chaplaincy program look like and what does it look like now?
Well, when I was hired, it was more based on the vision of the chief at the time. He didn't really know what he wanted. He just knew that he wanted something. And in some ways, it's one of those things that it happened once. I don't know if it would happen that way again. For me, personally, it's been a lot of fun because when I got hired, there was no job description. It wasn't really clear at all what I was going to do, except for staff support, but that was kind of vague. So the first year, it was a 0.2, and I kept my hospital job, you know, 4 days a week and EMS 1 day a week. I thought it looked pretty interesting. As I said, got to know different aspects of the organization. At the end of that year, my boss kind of surprised me. He said, well, this is going pretty good. Let's make it a 0.5. And I thought, whoa, what do you see that I don't see? So I knew that I needed to learn more about what EMS as an industry was all about. So I took the EMT course at a community college. I had done critical incident stress debriefing when I worked in the hospital. I was on a CISD team. So I was familiar with that model. And at one of the trainings that I went to for part of the CISM team, the trainer made this comment that really stayed with me. He was talking about the relationships that people need to build ahead of time. So when we show up on an event, that we all know each other and we can better collaborate and cooperate together. But the comment that he made was, the time of a crisis is not the time for us to be exchanging business cards. And that really stayed with me. So I kind of adapted that to EMS of thinking, you know, I need to be a little bit more proactive in my building relationships with all the people I'm here to support. Of course, I'm reactive. If they call me, I'll answer and I'll follow up in whatever way is appropriate. But part of me was thinking, you know, but why would any of these people talk to me if they don't know who I am? So I really wanted to build those relationships ahead of time. You know, and like I said, there was no job description. I just kind of figured it out as I went. But that was kind of a blessing and a curse because there were times when I thought, what am I going to do for EMS this week? And, you know, nobody was really managing or directing my work. So I just started doing a lot of ride-alongs and going over to the comm center and sitting with the dispatchers, found out where the headsets were. They have some that were specially designed for the people who are listening in because the microphone is turned off or it's taped up to the top, so there's no way I could say anything. but at least I could hear what the call was about.
Yeah.
And get some insight into the world that they live in every day.
Right. So you wrote a book, which is one of the reasons we got in touch. And when I was reading it, you talked about when you hear that there is a particularly hard call, you are the one who reaches out to the dispatchers. You just send them a text message and you say, hey, I heard about this call. How are you dealing with it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did a couple of things. One is because our company uses First Watch, we hardwired into the system a couple of triggers. You know, one is anytime there's a code 3 pediatric transport, I get an email. And then the other one is if there's any incident that involves more than one truck sent to the same scene. So those are some of the things, as well as the employees themselves or a supervisor or a coworker or somebody who's aware that somebody had a really difficult call will let me know, and then I can follow up with them.
In addition to supporting dispatchers and paramedics and EMTs with the big incidents, you also support them with cumulative stress. What does that look like? Do you have any examples of that?
Well, sometimes just coming to work in itself is an exercise in cumulative stress. When I talk to the dispatchers, the world they live in compared to the people out on the street, you know, the medics go on a call and then when they get done, they might have a little downtime to write their report. I mean, sometimes volumes are high and they really don't have much time at all between calls. But for the dispatchers, that's like that all the time. You know, if I catch somebody when they are taking a restroom break or getting a cup of coffee, you know, I might want to chat with them for a few minutes and they let me know, you know, like, well, it's been nice talking to you, but, you know, I need to get back to work. So that in itself is an exercise in cumulative stress. You know, the other piece sometimes is we do focus on the workplace stresses and those are real. The other part of it is we are all whole people and we bring work home and we bring home to work. And sometimes they intersect. Either we're just preoccupied with thinking about something at home or sometimes the call reminds us of somebody that we know and care about. So those are some of the hidden stresses too, that if somebody didn't tell me that, well, my kid's struggling in school or my parent is ill or, you know, whatever the issue happens to be. But by getting to know them, sometimes I can kind of see it on their face, like there's something else going on.
Right. In your book, you gave an example of a dispatcher or an EMT. I think it was an EMT who had had a particularly rough call and you went out and you got coffee and you just kind of talked about it. And you mentioned that you don't like to start the conversation with how are you, right? Because that's not a super useful question in this instance. You talk about other things and let them kind of come to you. But this EMT, this young man, you talked about the call and you kind of just went over it and you could see in his face that there was something else he wasn't talking about. And you asked him, you finally said, is there anything else? And he said, this person that this happened to, this person who died, they're the same age as my buddies. That could have been any one of my friends. And I thought that was really interesting because you do have to develop an instinct. Like dispatchers develop an instinct for calls and they trust their gut a lot. But I imagine as a chaplain, you've worked with so many people in so many different situations that you do. You have that instinct for there's something else going on here.
Yeah, in that case, you know, part of what made it easy in a way is that that EMT contacted me to say, can we meet for coffee? So I knew there was something else going on. But you're right, you know, it was like, well, tell me about the call. And at the beginning, it was sort of like reciting the patient care report. And I thought, well, okay, this is all very clinical, but why are we sitting here in this coffee shop? And so then the rest of the story came out. One of the things that I noticed after the first couple of years of working in EMS is I had some hunches and suspicions about how do people cope with the stress of this job. And I was guessing that it had to do with experience and education and what kind of support do you have at home? Like, how do people cope with the stress of a job like this? And I even wrote a reflection piece for our company newsletter saying, you know, how do people grow into their profession? But what I realized is I didn't really know any of those things. Those were all just guesses. I'm fortunate to work for a company that has a small research staff and an epidemiologist that we work with. So with her guidance, we put together the IRB Institutional Review Board approved study that can get published in a peer-reviewed journal. So it had that level of professionalism. And so those were some of our questions, is how do people cope with the stress of this job? And, you know, one of the tools that we used as part of that was an inventory of high stress calls, and it would rank them, you know, so there's 29 different event types, things that people do in the course of their job in EMS. I responded to the call of a senior citizen. I responded to a call in which someone had died, a multiple casualty incident, whatever they were. And the survey tool asked respondents to rank them, one, in order of frequency, you know, how often have you had a call like that? And second was, how hard do you think it would be for a person in your job, you know, not necessarily you, but how hard would this call be for somebody to respond to? And what we found is the things that we do the most often are the least stressful, which maybe is no surprise. But of all the different event types that were in that inventory, the thing that kind of jumped off the page for me was realizing that 7 of the top 8 most high stress events were all the pediatric calls. But I had asked our operations leaders to help me understand what were the kinds of calls that would merit a follow-up. And they came up with their top 10 of what they thought they were. So I had that to work off of. But after the research, I thought, you know, those top 10 are all very critical calls. But the PEDS ones really were the ones that staff themselves had identified. You know, so it wasn't me guessing what are the highest stress calls. They told us. So 7 of the top 8 highest stress calls were the pediatric. The 8th one was a call involving somebody that you know, either a family member, a friend, or a coworker. So I kind of rearranged my clinical practice. That's when we developed the First Watch tool to say, you know, well, I need to know when do we have a pediatric code 3 transport if we know that those are the highest stress calls. In response to your other question or observation about how to do that initial follow-up, you know, I don't find it particularly helpful to call somebody up and say, you know, how are you? Because in the moment, they might not even know. They're loaded with adrenaline and all those stress hormones that help us get through the incident. And it's kind of a setup anyway. If, you know, what are they supposed to say? I'm fine when they're not fine, or I'm doing okay, or to fall apart and burst into tears. I don't find that to be particularly helpful. I'd rather just acknowledge it, say, you know, I know you were on that call to a dispatcher. I understood that you took the call involving that crash, and there was a lot of noise in the background that potentially could have been pretty distressing. I just want you to know that I'm aware of it and I'm concerned about you and if there's anything we can do to support you. And then just leave it from there. So sometimes people will respond and say, you know, thanks for the outreach. I'm doing okay. Or, yeah, that one was pretty difficult. I'm more concerned about another employee. Or, yeah, that was really hard. Can we meet someplace and kind of debrief this? So I initially will just acknowledge it and express my concern and then just wait.
And that's all you can do sometimes. I like this idea that you're there, that you're part of the center, that you're part of the EMS crew, that you're part of dispatch, and you've built all these relationships so that you can support them and help them process things when they need it, right? It's almost the opposite of EMS, right? Where EMS shows up when you need help and then they're gone. Whereas what you're doing is more of a holistic home care practice where you check up and have relationships and just make sure that you've built that bank of trust so that they can come to you when they need to talk with someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of things that I've learned along the way. One is the importance of, I guess I'd have to say, assimilating into the organization, that I don't want to be perceived as voyeuristic or somebody from the outside who comes in and thinks they all have problems or any of that kind of thing. I want to just be seen as part of the landscape, you know, woven into the fabric of the organization. So when I show up, everybody just shrugs their shoulders and says, oh, okay, hi. You know, initially, especially in the hospital setting, I used to get the response of, you know, what do you know that I don't know and who sent you? That people really often do see the chaplain as kind of the grim reaper or the angel of death. And I got that a few times early on from some of the medics. It's like, you know, well, no, I don't think I need a chaplain. So what I just needed to do was take my time and show them what I do. That it's not all about that I think you need something as much as I'm concerned about you. We're all people, and I'm not immune from those stresses either. One was just kind of becoming integrated into the organization so that people would not be surprised when I show up. So when I do contact them after a call or anything, they don't think anything of. It's like, oh, this is just who we are and what we do. One of the shifts that I've really seen, I think this is happening in a lot of businesses, and we've seen it a lot more recently in the pandemic. It's just a concern about well-being and acknowledging the fact that life is difficult sometimes. And we just want to take care of everybody. You know, and Alina and any other company has a business interest in their employees taking care of themselves. We talk a lot about self-care. Sometimes if you look at the research on that, you know, it costs a lot of money to bring in a new employee and to orient and train them. And how long does it take before they're really up to speed and working independently? And so we have a corporate interest, financial interest in taking care of people and them taking care of themselves just so they stay around. Employee retention is really important. And I understand all that and I respect it, but that's not why I'm there. That's the corporate thing, and I get that, you know, but my perspective, my approach has been, you're a person, and I want to know that, you know, when you get off work at the end of the day and you go home, that you're going to be able to make that transition okay, and you're not taking it all out on the people that you go home to, that whatever we can do to help people take care of themselves. And since I am closer to retirement, I dropped my FTE. I was full-time, and I went down to a 0.6, and we hired 2 other chaplains. They each work one day a week, and they both come into this with mental health experience, which we thought was really important. That was my recommendation to leadership. Part of our succession planning is, what skill set do we really need for a job like this? I think some companies might decide they want to go with a social worker or a psychologist, and a lot of those are done on a referral basis. I think we kind of blended the two, and we said, no, I want to keep the proactive model with chaplains. But I think a lot of the younger chaplains especially are bringing a lot more of those clinical skills into the profession. So as we're thinking about the future of this job, you know, being able to bring those kind of skills and follow up with employees and let them know that we really do know what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. Even though you're not licensed, you still have experience. You still have worth. You still have value. Exactly.
Well, and our credentialing process is pretty rigorous. So it's maybe similar to certification in other fields. We have high expectations of each other.
Right. So if a manager or supervisor is listening to this episode and thinking about hiring a chaplain, what should they be thinking about? And what is the process like?
I would encourage them to really think about why. Why do they want to do this? And to make sure that they talk it over among themselves as a leadership team. And then to clarify with the employees why they're doing this. Sometimes there's initially a lot of, you know, just lack of understanding, like, well, why are we doing this? And is this a good use of financial resources and those kind of things? If the answer to the question is, well, we care about people and we want to add another layer of support, I think that kind of gets to the why question. And just acknowledging that, you know, we all know that this is a high stress job. We have our business interests in keeping people. We have a personal interest in each of you as employees, as individuals. We care about you.
And really, what more could you want?
Mm-hmm. If there was a main thing that I would want people to hear is that we want to constantly work to create and nurture our organizational culture so that it's a culture of trust. I have thought different times, if I could put all of my thoughts about this on a bumper sticker, it would be high expectations and high support. That we do expect a lot of our people, and we should. At the same time, we want them to know that we have their backs. People can come to work knowing that their boss, their peers in the organization as a whole is going to look out for them. That when you have one of those calls that you get off the radio and you take your headset off and you just want to put your head down on the desk and cry, that you have support. This is a tough job. It carries a lot of emotional weight. You know, sometimes you hear stories about what it used to be like. And I thought, yeah, maybe it's a good thing those days are behind us, because it's not just a matter of suck it up and get back out there. But it's, you know, this is real. This is a tough job. And we want to offer as much support as we can in as many different ways as we can. And I acknowledge that not everybody's going to want to talk to the chaplain. You know, sometimes people say, thanks, I'm fine, I have support somewhere else. They'll go to their supervisor, they'll go to their community resources, their own faith community, whatever that is. They might go to their peers and their friends. And I honestly don't care. You know, what I want to know is, I would tell people, I don't really care where you go for support. I just want to know that you have some.
I really like that phrase, the high expectations, high support, because there is such burnout rates in dispatchers. There's lots of burnout rates in all sorts of first responders, right? But especially in dispatchers, because they're invisible, like you talked about before. And so to have that high expectation to say, listen, we need you to keep taking these calls so that our community is protected. But in return, we need to protect you. We need to support you.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I love that. I love how you phrased that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think if there's a message that dispatchers need to hear, that might be it.
I agree. There's no limit to the amount of times we can tell dispatchers that they're important, that they're needed, and that we're going to support them in whatever way we can.
And this is a way to demonstrate that.
Exactly. So, as always, there are going to be relevant links in the show notes. There's going to be contact information for Russ in case you have any questions about EMS chaplains or anything of that sort. If you have questions for us at Dispatch in Depth, go ahead and email us at dispatchindepth@emergencydispatch.org. And Russ, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity and just wish everybody all the best in these difficult times we're living in.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch in Depth. Remember, it really helps if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch in Depth is hosted by me, Becca Barris. I'm also the technical director and producer, and Matthew Maiko is the executive producer.